Well, hello and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody checking out the show this week. And we've got a good show for you. We've got something a little bit different. We've been focusing a lot on federal resources and things like that, so we're going to take a turn and maybe look at some of the resources that different states bring to bear, and that'll be later on in this episode. But before we get on into all of that, I do want to welcome my co-host, as always, Sam Brown. Bradley. Sam, welcome to the show, or welcome back to the show. It's great to have you here with us again this week.
And I always love this, Jamie, as you well know. I will warn you, I'm at the firehouse, so you might hear a little fire noises, color in the background. This is going to be a really interesting subject that we're talking about today, because we haven't really focused on state teams that much, and maybe some of the different kind of disasters that people don't naturally think of as disasters. We have a guest today,
awesome.
My friend Brian, who I have known for quite a while, and he does, and this guy, he takes the word overachiever to a new high, and I'm just going to let Brian introduce himself, because he can tell you about himself much better than I can.
Thank you. Hi, I am Brian Froelke, and I am a newly board-certified EMS physician, and I work primarily as an ER doc in Level 1 Trauma Center here in Missouri in St. Louis area. And I also, when I'm not working inside the hospital, I'm out and about as a medical director for a EMS agency, a local EMS agency. I also wear a couple of other hats. I'm the state of Missouri EMS medical director, and I'm also the chief medical officer for the statewide disaster medical system. So a lot of different hats, but gives me the opportunity to get out of the office.
Yeah, you need to get out of the office once in a while, but I don't think people think that getting out of the office into more stuff like that is necessarily relaxing. But I welcome you to the show, Brian. I hope we can have you on many times in the future, because we're looking forward to hearing what you have to bring to the Disaster Podcast.
That would be great. Thank you for inviting me.
So before we get into talking with you about state resources, there have been a couple of things in the news. Most primarily, Sam, we were talking before we started recording, that mudslide in Snohomish County, Washington, where an entire side of a hillside came down and wiped out a community. At the count when we were recording this, it's about, I think they still have 90 people unaccounted for, and the death toll, confirmed death toll, is up close to 20, I believe. But just devastating. And I, as you said earlier, Sam, just points out that disaster comes in many forms.
Yeah, and the scary thing is that when we think of the death toll you usually see from the larger incidents, earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, it usually isn't that high. So here is a very localized event that probably only affected, you know, one neighborhood, but look at how many deaths came out of it. So, and the other scary part is, you know, you guys on the West East Coast had, and the Midwest as well, had so much more water, and we didn't have any. But, you know, what is this going to bear when the spring thaw comes? It's kind of scary to think about that.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of localized flooding here. And Brian, I don't know about you, in the Midwest, coming down the Mississippi River basin there, usually there's some flooding in the springtime. And I would expect with all the snow melt that there would probably be some coming your way.
Yes. Yeah, we're always waiting for that snow melt. We also were lucky to not have a tremendous amount of ice related issues and deployments this year as we've gone on in the past. But there were certainly a few here and there.
What are your thoughts about like state response with regard to that that mudslide? I mean, it really, just to hear the responders took quite a toll on the responders themselves, going in and having to dig through that mess to try to recover people.
Well, you know, something like this, with all disasters, they all start locally. And event like this, even in a neighborhood like this, will quickly overwhelm those local resources. The key is, for something like this, this is a no-notice event where you have no warning. You can't prepare like for a hurricane, and you can't see it coming. So it's more along the lines of that, like an earthquake, mudslide, tornadoes, those type of things, where you have very little warning. In this particular circumstance, the other key is that it's very time sensitive, because when you're talking about search and rescue type of efforts and so forth, there's a lot of time sensitivity to getting the resources there to save the lives that are that you can potentially save. And that's where, when you have regional and statewide resources, a lot of times those resources, when your local systems get overrun, are a little bit more readily available. For some of the larger gun federal resources, they always say somewhere around 72 hours. And especially for a no-notice event where they can't pre-deploy and prepare where they might be coming from, these state resources and regional resources are really key to filling that gap and getting the people and the equipment and the knowledge to the disaster area in a timely manner.
That's very true, because as they say, your federal resources, because first of all, the state has to request a federal declaration, and that takes some time, and then it takes about 72 hours, because some of those teams can be coming from all the way across the country, depending on who's on call that month. I want to mention, too, how Brian and I got to know each other. Some years ago, around 2006, I was working for the state of California, helping to create the California Medical Assistance Team, which is our state-level team, and I was reaching out to look for good models of teams that were already out there, and I met a young man named Tim Conley, and Illinois, which subsequently led me to Brian in Missouri. And I found that those two teams in particular were very well put together and had a good history. And, you know, Brian, like I said, we've talked about everything from CERTs to MRCs to DMATs and USARs, but not so much the state level. And I know that state teams across the country are in very different stages of development. We've even put together a nonprofit organization to kind of assist those teams in communicating with each other. But in Missouri, how is your team configured? Who runs it? How do you get deployed? Tell us more about how that works.
So in Missouri, we're actually a 501c3, a nonprofit organization. We are a team of medical folks, logistics folks, communications. We have the whole breadth, similar to like a modeled off of the Disaster Medical Assistance Team through National Disaster Medical System, or the DMATs. We're modeled similarly to them, although we are actually a deployable asset to the state through the State Emergency Management Agency. So we have a number of training exercises where we get the group together and we do formalized training, such as for air shows or state fairs, things like that, where we get the folks who participate on the team, who all, similar to the DMAT model, all have other jobs. They all have work in the hospitals, or they have regular jobs, and they come together as a team for training and for conferences and for events in order to respond. So that's our particular model, is a 501c that comes out of the State Emergency Management Agency.
So if there's a tornado coming, and like you said, sometimes we have notice, sometimes we don't, but you kind of know when there's a tornado potentially bearing down, although you don't know the effects of it until it actually hits, especially with tornadoes. But would the team pre-position itself, or would you just kind of stay on alert? What does your alert status look like?
So we're on call pretty much all of the time, but when there's potential weather hazards and so forth, we receive some situational updates where we're put on a status of, anticipating a potential problem. We have a website that you can go to, but a majority of the alerts are sent out via email. And then when we're activated or put in a readiness state, there's a call down list that often includes cell phone and multiple points of contact where they try to get a hold of us. What we find is that as we look at weather types of related incidents, we can see the bad weather pattern bearing down on us. But what we also see is that sometimes there will be events on one side of the state, such as in the Kansas City region, and the St. Louis region will have plenty of opportunity to prepare themselves. They might not necessarily respond over to Kansas City, but the St. Louis region can prepare themselves because there could be that same storm coming into the St. Louis area and causing devastation there. So we can kind of pre-deploy in a way because of our regionalization.
So you do have regionalized assets and subgroups of the state organization.
Yes, we split our statewide organization into three main parts and then another additional part. So we have the St. Louis area, the Kansas City area, and then the Branson area, where I'm actually calling you from right now. Our annual conference is occurring. And then we also have some mortuary assets and some other assets in the Jefferson City area, which is more centralized in the state.
So how often do you train together? Do you have big exercises where you invite everybody in, or do you do them more locally?
A kind of a combination. Each of our regions has their own different types of deployment options. Some of the folks will get some training associated with their local fire agencies or through their local response to mass gathering events, such as basically fairs or for the marathons, those type of things. But then from a statewide activation where the whole team has an opportunity to train, many of those trainings are in conjunction with a state fair or a large air show. There is one newer type of training that we've gotten a chance to participate in, and that's with our partnership with the state urban search and rescue team. We actually provide some medical backup and medical assistance to the search and rescue team for our state, which is also a federally deployable asset. And where this becomes important is that they have their own individual medical care that they can provide to their team and to back up their own team members. But when it comes to actual large numbers of casualties or patient care, that's where we step in to help provide that additional resource. And that's a perfect resource that would match with some of those things that you had mentioned going on with the mudslides, is that type of partnership with the search and rescue, and getting some of those assets and partners trained and working together is really important when an actual event occurs.
Right. So when the USAR people dig them out, then they need somebody to take care of them. So that kind of interoperability is really important. Brian, one thing I remember specific to your team was the infamous Joplin tornado. And I know you were boots on the ground on that one. Why don't you tell us something about that? What was that like?
Well, that was really, you know, I've been deployed to a number of events, but that one really was quite amazing in a couple of different ways. One is that the sheer breadth of the destruction, when you stand and look around, it essentially looked like a bomb had gone off. The other thing that was interesting about Joplin is this is one of those areas where we had the opportunity over in the St. Louis area to flip on the Weather Channel and see some of the things over the news. And almost simultaneously to seeing the news reports, we were getting our bags ready because we knew this was an event where we were going. You know, one of the major trauma centers in the area was hit, and so we had to kind of, you know, pick up and get ready to go. For an event like that, we didn't really have any alert status. We had no notice. It was just what came in over the airwaves and over our phones and pagers. Most of us have a ready bag, a 72-hour bag, and a bag that we can kind of pack with some additional resources for a planned deployment of about 72 hours up to a week or so.
What do you have in the way of logistics, Brian? Because, of course, I think on the DMAT side, where the plan is, you know, already set in place, where there are certain tents, there are medical supplies or support for the team. How does your team handle that? Is it less formal? Is it just like, we'll deal with it when we get there? How do you do that?
So we have a few different configurations. For a strike team, we have about 6 people that go out, and that includes logistics. It includes a physician and paramedics and a nurse, but that brings with it logistical support. That's typically a resource that includes a trailer that is self-sustaining, including some radio equipment, satellite phone, basic medical equipment, and a pull-out tent, a boot tent that attaches to it where you can start off right away starting and treating patients. Typically in that configuration, in a really austere environment, those 6 people will be able to sleep intermittently in the cab or in the trailer portion after all of the resources are pulled out.
Jamie, you must have some questions brewing.
I do. I do. When you get deployed, are you deployed instead of federal resources or prior to federal resources? What happens when federal assets are brought to bear?
So in Missouri, we're very lucky to have a pretty robust disaster medical response, as she had mentioned before, capability. We become one of the first lines of folks that are called to the scene when the local and regional assets are overwhelmed or going to be overwhelmed relatively quickly. The good news is that we have a very quick deployment capability, typically being up and operational within 8 hours, although typically within a couple hours of getting calls, because we all have other jobs that possibly with patient care where we need to get away, we can respond very quickly. And that's one of the available resources. The other possibility is that we become a deployable asset for emergency the emergency mutual aid compacts or a state-to-state EMAC, where we would become a potential state asset that could be shared. And so we often are able to respond quicker than the federal assets. And so typically our resources are deployed first and possibly even exhausted by the time the federal resources are able to bring their guns to bear.
So really it's a situation where, you know, you would almost expect that you're in the situation where you're going to get in there. You said like 72 hours of time where your resources are going to be overwhelmed, and it's going to be just enough time to get that federal resource in place to back you up at that point.
Typically, yes, we have 72 hours worth of capabilities. We are lucky to have some additional resources depending on the extent of the disaster, some of the redundancy of our individual regionalized plans, and some of the partnerships that we have with just-in-time delivery can really help support us beyond that 72-hour initial deployment. But yes, once we start using up all of our assets and the federal opportunities are needed, sometimes we end up bringing those in. For example, in Joplin, we had ample opportunities for to utilize our statewide resources, and there were not a large number of federal resources from a medical perspective that we required assistance from, which was a very large event, including a major hospital, and we were still capable of maintaining a majority of the medical care from our in-state capabilities with the help of that other organization that she was talking about before.
What's interesting, Jamie, and I've seen this happen a couple times, the first CalMAT deployment we had was the 2000 wildfires in San Diego, which was just carried a humongous amount of, involved in a humongous amount of area, and a lot of people were displaced. And that was the first time we called in our state team. But what was especially interesting for me, being a DMATter, is the fact that when the DMATters came in, watching that integration between the CalMAT folks, which are a lot of our own DMATters, and the DMAT folks, and I've seen that a couple times. I deployed to Hurricane Sandy after the fact, and it was so gratifying to see an emergency room with all the ER people that work there, mixed with federal uniforms doing the same job, and everybody worked together like they had known each other forever. In fact, I think friendships were formed that are still going on. Brian, tell us what was your, I guess I love hearing war stories, but what was it like your first day when you got down there and you really saw what you were dealing with and you first started interacting with people? What was that like?
So we ended up going down within a couple hours. We were able to get on the road and get into that into the area. What struck me first of all was that it was perhaps 2 o'clock in the evening, maybe a little bit before then, when we rolled into the area where we were going to be setting up our tents. And it was an abandoned car lot. And what was really interesting is that it was just pitch black. There wasn't a streetlight out there. And so short of being blinded by our own emergency lights in the area, there wasn't anything that we could see around us to give us an impression of the devastation and what was around us. We were all following single file line, and none of us really could tell anything that was going on. it was not until that next morning, as the sun started coming up, after we had kind of pressed to put the tent up and got all the cots out and things like that, that we started to realize that the real depth of destruction as we could start to see around us. The way that we were deployed, we did not start seeing patients immediately. They had some curfews in place, and they had some more localized clusters of medical care that were being provided over by the hospital and a couple of other areas. We soon integrated with some of that local response. So some of the local medical care that was being provided, we started to help out and provide care, and then started to divert the patients over to our area.
How long were you actually down there from the time you arrived?
I want to say it was a couple of weeks. For an event that size, a couple of weeks actually is sometimes even a normal deployment length for the medical folks in the disaster in the DMATs. But for us, that was a pretty extended deployment. We had the opportunity in that time of providing not just the strike team care for that immediate, some of those folks that were still needing the local assistance, but also we were able to set up a 35-bed emergency department capable tent setup. And then we actually ended up with a 60-bed emergency basically hospital that was set up as well during that entire two-week period. And we were able to train the local hospital staff and the local folks to be able to staff that tent hospital, and then slowly started to pull down our own medical resources and logistical resources as we ended up going back home.
Wow.
And so, if I remember correctly, just to refresh everyone's memory, the hospital in that area sustained a major hit in this event. Am I correct?
Correct. Yes. The major trauma center in that area was the entire hospital was shifted on its foundation by a few inches and had to be entirely evacuated. They were lucky enough to have another hospital in the area that could take some of the burden of those patients that needed to be evacuated. But that particular hospital also suffered substantial communication breakdown and other resources in the area that were not able to be supplied to it. When I actually visited that other hospital for the first time, there was a large oxygen tank that I remember sitting next to that hospital, and the brick wall that normally surrounds that oxygen tank was crumbled. So that's how close the devastation came to that other hospital.
Wow.
Yeah, and it just, again, this is why we have these different layers of resources, because we think of the devastation and things that happen to individual homes and businesses, but it can be particularly problematic when infrastructure resources like a hospital are also affected substantially. That happened in Katrina and other disasters as well. And when those things happen, it really overwhelms things quickly.
That's what really changes the nature of a disaster, because if you have something where the infrastructure is still intact, then we kind of go in as surge capacity. We go in as extra hands to help with the overflow. But when you have a situation where the entire infrastructure is gone, and like you said, Jamie, Katrina was a great example of that, then these federal and state assets, they bring the hospitals with them. So, Ryan, when you were talking about creating that hospital, was that like one of these inflatable mobile hospitals? How did that thing work?
So it was basically a large dome-shaped hospital that basically had basically the curved structure similar to the military style. I can't think of the name of the military equivalent, but basically long tubes that interconnect that had multiple different wings. There were about 60 beds capacity, all in said. But then in addition to those resources that we were able to stock it for that particular hospital, we also had to bring in other assets from all over the country, CT scanners, MRI, surgical semi-trailers, and so forth, that would add additional capability to the tent that we were able to set up.
Yeah, boy, the resource ordering alone, I mean, the feds have a pretty good system for doing that, and they have people in place that do that. But on a state level, I can only imagine. In fact, I think I remember getting involved in that. You guys were having me do internet research for you, looking for some of those assets. But the nice thing is there are so many of those that are mobile, and there's companies that have all those devices that they can bring out to you. How do you guys handle all that resource ordering?
Well, it's actually rather challenging, and part of the reason why that collaborative effort between state disaster medical assets is very important. First of all, you have to identify the need, which is relatively easy, but you know, determining actually what the need is, and then being able to request that need in such a way that the Emergency Operations Center understands what you need and can go find it. So what we need to do is we need to look at the National Incident Management System, or NIMS, typing of assets, where we can determine what type of medical assets look like what. You know, what does a portable CT scanner look like? What does an MRI scanner look like in those particular schemas? The other thing that we need to do is figure out where these potential assets might come from. And so, especially on a state-to-state basis, you need to reach out. You know, the governor's reaching out to other states to support, but we have to give them the tools and the location to look. And that's where some of these collaborative efforts, where we create these partnerships between the state teams and assets, behind the scenes, you have an idea of who you need to ask so that you can pre-script some of these requests in such a way that they can make it through the channels much easier.
And so you just have an open checkbook here. How does all of this get paid for through the state?
Well, the very important part about the whole thing is that you follow, as all disasters start at the local level, you have to make sure that you follow that chain all the way through the Emergency Operations Center. So any assets that come in to bear have to be requested by somebody at that local level for a specific need. And that chain needs to be unbroken for those assets that come in to be able to potentially apply for reimbursement. For a period of time, we have things, you know, familiar in the fire world and the EMS world about, you know, for mutual aid, where you basically ask for help from your partners, and there's no specific expectation of any reimbursement for that assistance. But eventually, as a disaster gets larger and larger, you have other funding pools that can come about, with the possibility of the FEMA or the emergency management agencies getting involved, where you have federal resources and federal dollars that can help reimburse some of that cost.
Well, I'm going to ask one more question and throw it back to Jamie, because I'm so fascinated with this. It's like I won't shut up. But you know, when you walked away from that weeks later, what were some of the lessons learned that you took away with you that you would now integrate into your operational plan the next time?
So one of the big lessons learned that we're actually still in the process of working out is that when it comes to medical resources, what we're looking at is looking at medical direction and medical control. It's something that's commonly utilized by the EMS communities for online or offline, looking at protocols, calling into the control hospitals, and so forth. But when you're managing EMS assets from potentially all over the country that come in to assist, they all typically bring the protocols that they are normally working with. But sometimes those protocols don't necessarily fit the resources that are available in a particular disaster. And what we're looking for is ways to try to mold a medical control and a medical direction at a more regional and statewide level that can assist some of those assets so that we not only identify the medical need at the local level, but we have some champion that can assist with helping figure out how to translate that into EOC type of language. And that was one area where there were some challenges at getting some of those medical needs all the way through the system so that we ended up getting what we were looking for.
Brian, as we wrap up here, because we could all keep talking about this for the rest of the evening, but this just leaves them wanting more, and we'll have you on in a future episode. But as we wrap up here, if you had somebody that was listening to this that said, I want to be part of a state response unit, is there any place that they can go to find out, A, if their state has such a unit, and B, can they apply for it in some way?
That's a wonderful question. First of all, I'm very happy that they would be asking about helping out at this stage, because you really want to get involved in some sort of an organized team or some sort of an organized group before you would deploy. We have a lot of problems sometimes with folks that try to do the right thing and end up deploying, self-deploying, without that logistical infrastructure and without those capabilities supporting them, that can sometimes end up more of a problem than a help, no matter how well-meaning. So the second part of that question is, I would probably direct them, in addition to their local CERT team, I would consider referring them to the, oh gosh, it's a really long phrase, the ESAR VIP program. And I'm probably going to have to quick Google it to tell you exactly, but it's a volunteer health professional or health professions emergency.
This is the beauty of podcasting, because Brian, what we'll do is we'll actually put a link to that in the show notes and have it all written out. But
excellent. But every state.
Yeah, it allows people to be in a pool of available, you know, if they're not associated with a specific team, or sometimes when they are, like an MRC, we have that in California, but it allows people to be available. And what this ESAR bit does is it when they put their credentials into the system, it keeps them updated. So they know if they call on you that you actually are a medical professional and that you have current certifications and licenses. That's pretty much in a nutshell.
Yes, and it's available in every state, has a program. They might not necessarily be that full mouthful. In Missouri, it's called Show Me Response. So a lot of them have better names and better ways of accessing them. Just for the record, it's Emergency System for Advancing Registration of Volunteer Health Professionals.
That must have been invented by somebody at the federal level.
Yeah.
So there's a tongue twister for you.
Well, we'll definitely have that explained out in the show notes for this episode. And Brian, thank you so much for taking time. I know you've got an incredibly busy day, and so for squeezing out 45 minutes or so of your time to join us and just chat with us about what you do at the state level in Missouri. It sounds like Missouri is very well taken care of.
We're very lucky that way. And yes, I could talk about this all day. So,
well, we'll have an opportunity to do it again, I'm sure.
Definitely. Well, Sam, you know, we want to make sure everybody remembers they can always find more episodes of the Disaster Podcast over at disasterpodcast.com. If you have a question for Brian, or you have a question for Sam or I, or any of our other guests on the show, remember, you can always just leave a note in the comments area for any of the episodes, and that emails us directly, and we can put you in contact with Brian or get the answer for you that you're looking for, because this is a community effort here and we want you to be part of it. So if you've got something you want to learn more about, you've got a topic you'd like us to cover, make sure you leave that comment and let us know so we can bring that to you in a future episode. Sam, where can folks find you?
Oh, pretty much anywhere on the internet, certainly through the website, like you mentioned, and we'd love to hear from you. Sam Bradley on Facebook, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter. And if you put in Sam Bradley, you're going to find me somewhere. I don't think, strangely enough, there's not that many of us. It usually goes back to me in some fashion.
You're out there. Definitely easy to find.
I know I'm out there, but that's another story.
Brian, is there any way folks can easily catch up with you? Do you have a website or something?
So we do have a website. Actually, I have a number of different hats, but the one the easiest way to get through to me is through my university email. It's the one that has the fewest spam filters that would otherwise cripple my getting it. And that would be FROELKEB, or Froelke B, at wusm.wustl.edu. And I found the most success with that particular email address.
And I'll put that email address and link in the show notes as well. Thanks. So if folks want to catch up with you. As always, people can find me under PodMedic on most of the social media sites and places out there. And of course, all of my other programs and podcasts and ventures are available for you to catch up with over at medicast.com. As always, this is the Disaster Podcast at disasterpodcast.com. And, you know, Sam, we learn more about this each and every time, but, you know, this isn't this is a different type of thing we're dealing with when we talk about disaster medicine.
And I can't wait for Dr. Joe Hawley to listen to this, because even though this happens so quickly that we didn't have time to get him in on it, he's going to really enjoy this. And you both had the opportunity of meeting Brian when we were down in New Orleans. Where were we? Vegas.
We were out in Vegas on that one. And we do want to thank Joe and Paragon Medical Education Group for sponsoring our podcast so that we can bring people like Brian to you each and every week. Make sure you check them out over at their site, and that's ParagonMedicalGroup.com. So check them out, and you can also find them on Twitter. I'll have a link to them in the show notes as well.
Can't wait for more, Brian. That's all I got. This one conversation could have spun off into so many different subjects, so we're definitely going to get you back, maybe when your time is a little less limited and we can venture forth again.
Sounds great. And sorry about that, too, with the conference.
No, perfect. We so appreciate it. He's in between lectures he was doing today and giving a speech at a dinner tonight. So we were really lucky to squeeze this out.
We really appreciate it, Brian. Thank you so much. Sam, you want to wrap us up?
Well, and I think what we were talking about today, whatever level of disaster we're talking about, it's still abundantly clear that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.